what I'm going to talk to you about is the role of open technologies. So, and the full suite, open standards, open data, open source, and transparency in the context of archives. And in particular, this question of what evidence we have of now and what evidence people in future will have of today. So, firstly, a little bit about me. For those of you who don't know me, my day job is as a civil servant, and I'm the digital director at the National Archives. And we are the official archive of the UK government. If you look at our website, we'll say things like 1,000 years of history. It's actually a pretty cool and amazing place. We've got something like 200 kilometres of records. And they cover the most extraordinary range of activities that the British state has been involved with. Now, people imagine that archives are about the past, and we tend to talk about our work very much in terms of supporting historians, understanding the past. But the thing that's really interesting for me is the future, because the evidence that we look after provides the lens through which people in future will come to understand the past and come to understand our times. Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of a crash course in archiving so that you get a sense for the challenge that digital technologies and digital records, digital information, poses to archives. Then talk a little bit about the postmodernist critique of archives, which is about who has power to decide what evidence will be kept. I'm going to talk a little bit about the contribution that open technologies make in this question of what evidence the future will have. So, archives. What do we do? Well, there's three things, really. The first is that we preserve information. And for physical records, it's very easy. Essentially, you get handed a box and you put it on a shelf in a temperature-controlled environment. The second is that you provide access to it. So the information that you have is available for other people to look at. And typically, physical archives have a reading room, and you can come along to somewhere like the National Archives, get a reader's ticket, ask to see a box, get a box, look at the contents of the box. And the third is that we provide context. So context is about how you ascribe some evidential value to the information that you're looking at or using. Who made it, and what were they doing, and why? Now, context is an interesting thing, because the context of information when it's created and the context when we look at that information today changes. The records, for example, of the Alan Turing trial, from the perspective of the time of that trial, would have been viewed as a record of his guilt of a criminal offence, and perhaps in society, potentially viewed as a record of deviance. From the perspective of today, many people look at that record and say, that's a record of homophobia in our law. And celebrate the change of the law that happened now 40 years ago, 1967. So how we view the evidence changes from the perspective of today. And archives provide some of that context. We're also in the business of receiving information. And this is where life gets interesting, because somewhere along the line, someone makes decisions about this is what's important that needs to be kept. Now, a little while ago, right the way back in the 1970s, the postmodernist philosophers got very interested in this question of who has the power to decide what evidence is kept for the future. And there are places in the world where archives hold evidence of significant human rights abuses. There have been times when people have tried to rewrite the evidence. There are archives where people turn up with AK-47s to destroy the evidence. And the postmodernists were very concerned about this question of power. The power to decide what evidence is kept. Now, for archives, almost the entirety of our practice as institutions has been designed around attributes of the physicality of the record. And yet, we have seen accelerating a shift to most of the information that we care about today being encoded in digital forms. So this poses a really big challenge to archives, not least in terms of how we go about the business of preserving the information, but also the tension that there is in terms of how we make that information available. Now, digital preservation is a tricky business to be in. There's no long-term form for storing data. It's a function of the economics of storage that, typically a hard disk you'd expect to last for 5 years. Even tapes, if you write your material to tape, which is one of the things that we do, the lifetime of a tape will be perhaps 20 years. This is not very long for an archive. So you are in the business of copying, relentlessly copying over time the records that you're preserving and checking that you have the same thing each time you make a copy. The second thing you need to do is you need to understand what it is that you have so that you know that you can produce the record when someone wants to see it, that you can provide some sense of access. Now, again, for physical records, this is easy because you have a box. For digital material, you always have a dependency. You have the relationship between the noughts and ones, the data that you are relentlessly copying, and the code you need to execute, the code that you need to run in order to give life to that data, give life to that information, allow someone to use it or to access it. And of course, records can be all sorts of different types of things. They can be relational data sets, they can be document formats, they can be email, they can be neural networks. So a digital archive needs to have quite a sophisticated capability to understand what code it needs to have the capability to run in order to be able to produce the records that it's preserving. And it needs to manage that capability with and through each generation of technological change. Now, this is relatively easy within a generation of technology and gets harder as you start moving generations of technology out. And you have some decision-making to do. You have to decide how you translate your money, which is your truly finite quantity, into the maximum mitigation of your digital preservation risks. So, why does Open help with all of this? The first is the benefit of open standards. Information that's encoded in an open standard format is easier to preserve and more likely to be preserved and to last because twofold. One is that generally as part of the standardisation process, you will have more than one set of software that is capable of processing the information. You'll often have multiple applications, multiple code routines that can work with the information that you're preserving. And the form of the information itself will be reasonably well documented and archived. So open standards significantly chip away at the preservation risk in this complex risk landscape. The second is around open source. Now, if digital information, in order to produce information in future, the information that we have today, you need to have both, if you like, the data and the ability to produce it in some sense, some software, some code, whoever's running the code needs to have the right to be able to do that. Now, that might be for a piece of commercial software that you've bought a license. Or it might be that the license is an open license. Now, clearly, archives, not being rich organisations, can't go around about a place buying thousands of variations of license. And we don't have yet an equivalent to legal deposit for software. Clearly, open source software, where memory institutions have the same rights as everybody else has to run that code, significantly helps us. And in particular, open software that processes information that's encoded in open standards, again, significantly lowers the difficulty, the complexity of keeping that information for the future. The third is around open data, that information is increasingly dependent on other facts, other data. Even something as simple as a PowerPoint presentation may contain some photographs. And the owner of the photograph that you put in your PowerPoint presentation is probably not the same person who produced the bullet points. So we see the information that we need to preserve becoming more complex mixtures of information produced by different people. And archives and libraries don't have any special rights or privileges to infringe other people's intellectual property rights. The British Library has an enormous archive of websites. We have a reasonably significant archive of websites of government. We're able to make that available openly because it's information that the government owns. The British Library isn't able to publish its 2 petabytes of web archive because it doesn't own most of that material. So intellectual property rights in terms of access to information that's being preserved constrains memory organisations in terms of how they go about providing access. They can't just publish information, even though they can provide ways for people to be able to inspect the information or to be able to use it. Now, where we have open information, information that's openly licensed, then the memory institution can make that information available. And use of information is one of the best guarantors for continuing to make the engineering effort for that information to be available in future. So open licensing and open data, again, has a really big impact on lowering the preservation risk and therefore increasing the chances that information will be available. Because it can be used, and because, not least, memory institutions, libraries and archives can reproduce that information. And the fourth area is about transparency of practice. So we've gone from an era where, propositionally, organisations like ours have set out to preserve all of the records that are handed to us. And so long as we have, for the physical record, a nice repository and we can control the environment, we can do a pretty good job with that. But for digital records, we are moving from being an organisation that essentially provides a single capability around storage and preservation to being an organisation that has to make decisions about which types of digital preservation risk are we going to mitigate? Which problems do we set out to solve? And at what point does it just become too hard to do anything more than just keep the bits, retain the noughts and ones, but perhaps lose the capability to produce the record, to hand it to somebody, beyond handing them the noughts and ones? Now, that makes the memory organisation a much more active decision maker than it's hitherto been in this question of what evidence will people in future have of today. And if memory institutions are going to be making those kinds of decisions, by dint of necessarily choosing how they manage the digital preservation risks, then it becomes important that they're clear about how they're going about that kind of decision making. Now, there's a bunch of practices that we can imagine memory institutions starting to follow. Publishing hashes of the records that we're preserving, particularly closed records, things that you can't see today, so that you can verify when you can see them that the information hasn't been changed in the meantime. Publishing information about what risks you think your collection has and what steps you're taking, what decisions you're making to mitigate the risks that you see. Open practice is one of the best ways in which memory institutions can be held accountable and that people can see how they're deciding to adapt, manage, mitigate the preservation risks that they have. And as this starts to happen increasingly rapidly with and through each generation of technological change, and the decision-making happening much more rapidly, giving people a wider view and a wider say. So that's all I had to say. Hopefully, I've given you a little bit of a fresh insight into the role and work of archives, some of the power issues that are at play, the importance in terms of the future from the sets of decisions that are being made now about what information is kept, the difficulty of preserving particularly digital information in the long run, and the important contribution that all of the things that those of us who care about open, the important contribution that open standards, open source, open data, and open practice makes to lowering preservation risks and giving a much better prospect that the digital record that we have of not least our government today will be available for people to access and use and interrogate and interpret in the future.
Are you going to have some questions? Because I was going to ask about of preference have physical media, so if a book is available as paper and as an e-book, you go for the paper because you can preserve that, whereas the e-book would be locked up with DRM and things like that, and you can't make it available, you can't use it, you can't do any things, do all these things with it, what you need to do.
So for archives, generally, the stuff we have, there's only one copy. So it's not that physical material is safer, it's just it's a completely different set of risks. So if you've got one copy of a record, then obviously if that thing is lost or damaged or there's a fire or, you know, then it's gone. So for a digital thing you can make many copies and in principle from that perspective it's safer. But you have to then actively manage the copying and the capability to produce the things. You've got more work to do. So you don't like escape the decision making about what steps do you make to intervene to mitigate the risks. Just the risk landscape looks really different. On the question of DRM, the legal deposit regulations give the legal deposit libraries the power to say to anyone depositing information with them electronically that they have to remove DRM before depositing the information. Now, we don't have anything quite like that, and there may well be bits of the public record. It's one of the things that you sit and think, oh gosh, what do you do about that? Bits of the public record start acquiring digital rights management technology. From our perspective, it just increases the risk because you produce another dependency on something else.
I presume the National Archives has digital media, some of which is not going to be open for 50, 70, 100 years. How do you plan for computer security to last that long, to stop people accessing it before it's due to be published?
So, at some point you rely on institutional commitment. There's no technological means for doing that. There's no system or engineering approach that can guarantee that this information will be closed for that period of time. All you can do is make sure that today you have the ability to look after the information that's closed, and that you have the institutional commitment so that you can hand the baton on to the next generation of people in the institution to keep doing that work. And that's all you can really do. I think transparency of practice then becomes really important in that regard, that you have the ability to get some sense of, is this happening?
I'm curious, do you keep, floppy disks in concrete vaults?
No. And that's the physical media dies too fast, so you have to concentrate on preserving the information content. You have no choice, and you have to build your practice to concentrate on preserving the information content.
Can you give us any examples of any digital data that we've lost?
So, I mean, there are some bad examples that are well known, if you like, not so much lost, but as hard to read. And the one that's often talked about in the digital preservation community is the BBC Doomsday Project. Now, what's interesting about that is that, and we've got a copy of the disk and some of the hardware, and there are other places we can go and access the hardware. The interesting thing about that is what's getting in our way, and it's partly to do with the rights issues associated with how that content was encoded, that means that it's quite difficult, and it was revolutionary at the time, it's quite difficult to just lift and shift it and make a copy and make that material available. So that's the example people often cite. We're good at keeping stuff, so if information makes it to us, it doesn't get lost.
So, John, I'm interested that National Archives is located by a river. So is that, you sort of say you're really good at keeping stuff, but isn't that, like, if you put it somewhere, is your stuff by the river, or is it in a salt mine somewhere?
The physical stuff.
Yeah.
So most of it is by the river. albeit that we have these, I think every you visited the National Archives of Kew, we have this kind of lovely water features in front of the building, which I'm told are part of the flood defence features for the local area.
I just thought you'd have enough risk, you thought you built some ponds down there as well.
I'm sure it was all very carefully worked out. Thankfully, I'm not responsible for worrying about the physical preservation risks. And you can obviously mitigate some of those risks by digitising your content. We've only digitised, it's about 6% of the 200-odd kilometres of records that we've got. And physical risk is the biggest risk to the collection. So managing the environment and managing the age of... particularly around things like deciding how you spend your money in terms of essentially chilling when it's hot, warming when it's cold, and how much of that do you try and do, and how much of an even temperature do you want to have, is part and parcel of the physical archive's work. The digital archive has the same sorts of decision-making to do, just in a much more complex, much more diverse, and much more rapidly changing risk landscape. And that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah.
You said that the British Library can't make websites available yet. The Internet Archive and Google both do that. So why is the British Library in a worse copyright position than those two?
So that would be where do you put your appetite for essentially being sued in terms of infringing copyright. So, well, it's interesting because the Internet Archive are in a situation where, and Brewster Cahill, who is an absolute legendary figure, I'm a huge fan of Brewster. Brewster has a wonderful approach, which is we will copy the material. Of course, we will. We're an archive. That's what we do. If you don't like what we've done, we'll take it down. So if you complain, we'll take it down. And in extremis, you could sue them. The problem with us is that we're a crown body, so if you're suing us, it might really be worth your while. Our risk appetite necessarily has to be very different in terms of things like intellectual property right infringement. Necessarily.
It's not true. For a crown body, the crown can make laws around copyright. There's explicit provision to cover out the crown could exempt things. So you have force majeure there in the UK ethics.
Well, so... it's very interesting. If you get into the intersection of the Public Records Act and Section 50 of the Copyright Designs and Patents Act, and how far does that go, you get into an area of some ambiguity. It's not as clear as you'd like it to be.
No, but I spent a long time reading the Copyright my sins, and there are the Crown has quite impressive powers, especially compared to the US.
So some of that's why we're able to make our web archive available openly on the web in terms of where we see our risk appetite. But it doesn't go as far as you might always like.
There was a recent post from archive.org saying they're not going to obey robots on text. Any thoughts on that?
I can see why. When we archive government websites, we don't obey robots.txt. As I say, when we are doing our own web archiving for government, it would be out of our remit. So,
following on from Anna's talk about the importance of land ownership, geographical data, and so on for future contexts. Is sort of quite obvious, but given the commercial restrictions on the ordinary survey, on postcode data, on the land registry, on Inspire and so on, it's not something that's going to be archived by the state as far as I can see. So I guess you could ask, maybe encourage people working on OpenStreetMap, you should be archiving snapshots of OpenStreetMap, or what alternatives are there to make sure that basic information that is really national information but can't be archived by the National Archive actually gets stored archived somewhere? Is it just pressing to change the law?
So at the moment, Ordnance Survey is under the Public Records Act a place of deposit, including for the digital information that it has. So that information is a public record and its preservation is currently looked after by the Ordnance Survey.
But it's closed to information, presumably, because I can't download the...
That's right.
Okay. And land ownership and land registry is...
Similarly, a public record.
Right.
Let's get this way.
I think it's every new year, public records from so many... 50 comes to mind, get published from 50 years ago. Would that apply to the Ordnance Survey data that's now closed in 50 or however many years it is?
Yeah, it will. This is very interesting. When Gordon Brown was Prime Minister, he asked Paul Dacre to conduct a review. So you can have a little look at this. One of the things that came out of that review was a change in the period of time where normally information would be available, open for people to inspect, if it has been selected for long-term preservation. So when the Public Records Act was first passed, this period of time was 50 years. Then it moved down to 30 years. And since, I think, 2013, we've been moving in 2-year steps down to 20 years. It's a very interesting time because you've got two things happening at the same time. One is this shift from 30 to 20 years, and at the same time, a shift in terms of the form of the record moving from paper to digital, kind of intersecting. And it makes the next 5 years really, really, really interesting in terms of how all of that pans out.
If the people with AK-47s did turn up at your door and told them to delete all the data, how hard would it be for you to do that?
I think we think quite hard. There aren't many people who you could point a gun at who would know where to begin to do that, so you'd have to be reasonably lucky in terms of
Is there a single point of failure? It's like, is there somebody who has access to all the data who could actually do it?
Don't tell him!
I can tell you it'd be no good pointing a gun at me.
I got about 6 terabytes worth of videos from local council meetings in Cambridge that I've been collecting and publishing on YouTube. And as you mentioned earlier, there's no standard for depositing video archives. Given that a lot of footage by YouTube reporters has been put up on the internet on YouTube, what means does the National Archives have for accessing and archiving things put up by independent people that are of national significance or even local significance in local areas?
So if it's published, so we're mainly about the public record. If it's published, then it's the purview of particularly the British Library, the work that they do around web archiving, which will include archiving YouTube. If it's been published by government, then we'll archive it off YouTube as well. There's some wonderful organisations. The Open Preservation Consortium have done some amazing work, and a big bunch of the tools that have been developed around web archiving have only been developed and are being used because they're open source. Again, another kind of open comes to the rescue for the future.
So what do I do with these hard drives that I'm collecting? Ultimately, do I just take them along to
If you publish them on the web, then there's a fair chance they will be caught in terms of being web archived. So publish them on the web.
Also, send them to Internet Archive because they'll accept video depositions as well.
That's a good idea. The Internet Archive is a good idea. Right, we've run out of time. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.